don't think they need this on me. But so thank you for having me. I'm super excited to be here today. My name is Ragna Jericho, and I think Paula summed me up pretty well. I spent my first 8 years in my start of my career working with children with developmental disabilities, and I loved it. It was a challenging job, and I loved every minute of it. I loved those kids, and I was realizing that a lot of times the diagnosis that they were given was not the issue for them. It was stuff going on at home, and I didn't have the background or expertise to start to even begin to address anything with adults. That's why I decided to go back to school and put myself through that torture, but to gain the education and experience to be able to work with adults. And then in my internship for that, I worked with adults with addiction, and I loved that too. I thought that would be really scary and challenging for me. I have some family history that ended in some really sad situations for our family. So I thought I might even have some biases or something going into that. I loved every single one of the people that came through there. So, but I missed the kids. And that's when I started looking for an opportunity to work with families again. And I came across the Caring Place, which I had never heard of until I was looking for a job. And now my job is to make sure that people like me have heard of it. So people who are working with children and families know about the Caring Place. So I'll give a little bit of an overview of what the Caring Place does, but I want to get into what grief looks like in children, because I think that's more so what you're here to learn about today, and then I can answer any questions about referral processes to our particular program. Our program is peer support. It's not counseling or therapy. It is an opportunity for families of grieving children to meet other families of grieving children. So the program is child-focused. I like to call it this, child-focused, family-based peer support, which is a mouthful. But the program is truly designed to support children who are grieving. So a family must have a grieving child to come there. And we look at children as high school graduation down to infants. It's family-based because we don't have adults dropping children at the door. We know that grief affects entire families. And the best thing that an adult can give to their child is a healthy adult who is also seeking help and support. And they're modeling for their child what to do when they're hurting. And then it's peer support because it's not counseling. However, while it's not therapy, it's extremely therapeutic to meet somebody in a similar situation. What we know about kids is that a 10-year-old who just lost his dad thinks that he's probably the only 10-year-old in the world who's ever lost his dad. And he doesn't think anyone can possibly understand what he's going through. To meet another 10-year-old is life-changing. To meet a kid that maybe feels the way I do, has had a similar experience, that changes their world. So to have an opportunity to do that, or for now a father going it alone, to meet another dad whose wife has died, that I think might be the most therapeutic thing that could ever happen for them. We also have a stigma around counseling, a lot still. I think we're getting somewhere with that, but there's still a stigma. And because we're not doing counseling, we can throw the stigma out the window. People don't have to worry about that. We don't bill anything. The program is completely free of charge. And although it's a Highmark program that Highmark offers to the community, there is no cost for it whatsoever. And I'm going to ask Paula to remind me to get into a little bit of the history later if we have time. But I'm going to keep my eye on the clock and try to talk fast. I tend to bounce around a little bit, so I apologize. Buckle up. It'll be a bouncy ride. I hope it's a good ride, but I get really excited about what we do, which sounds weird to get excited about children who are grieving, but I think what we do and the way we look at it is so good and can really be applied to so many situations, children, adults, death, loss that has nothing to do with death. So I hope that you feel like you've gotten something when you leave here today, and please, this is not to be formal. I want you to make comments and questions as we're going, so please be comfortable with that. And take care of yourselves. If you need to go do something, please go. You're not going to offend me at all.
I need to close the door now.
Get it started. Get out of here. All right. So how many people are familiar with the stages of grief? I don't want to offend anybody. Okay. I don't want to offend anybody. I don't like the stages of grief. In my opinion, they are very clean and linear and in a forward-moving direction. And I know I don't grieve that way. And I know most people in my world don't grieve that way. The stages kind of imply that you do your work here at stage one, you get through that, and then you move forward to stage two. You do what you need to do there, you move on to stage three. And so then we have parents calling the caring place saying, I'm really screwing up grief because I was at stage three and then I was driving in the car and a song came on and now I'm back to stage one. And I'm seeing my kids do this. I'm seeing my kids kind of all over the place. So not only am I messing up my own grief, I'm messing them up and I'm messing their grief up. And we're there to say, throw it out the window. Get rid of the idea of stages. Get rid of the idea of timelines, because that's just not how it is. We take a very different approach, but before I get into that, I would like to see if you kind of have some thoughts about what, if I were to say the word grief journey, what would you picture? What do you think that would entail? What is a grief journey? What would that look like?
It's a very winding, serpentine, crisscross, back and forth road.
And we're done.
And you're never really done. You're never ever the same.
Kind of like a roller coaster.
Absolutely. Windy, crisscross, roller coaster. We've got the ups, we've got the downs, we've got the sudden turn to the left that you didn't expect. It's all over the place. That does not work with stages. And Kubler-Ross never meant the stages to be applied to after death. It was for the person who is dying to get to a place of accepting that they're dying. It's not for the rest of us who are left behind to grieve, because it just doesn't work that way. So somehow in the world that got a little bit convoluted and the message was different than it was initially intended. But we tend, yes.
Yeah, I also... I guess it was because of my the grief work I've done, learned that, you know, those are five stages, mm-hmm. but they don't necessarily follow 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. These are the stages that you experience, and you go back and forth among them.
Exactly. And when we put things in an order, I know myself, and I think our culture tends to try to follow the order. Mm-hmm. You know, we like to be told what to do. We like to have a system to follow. And grief just isn't that way. So we follow a model that looks like a toy, but it is the model of the spiral of grief. And if you just entertain this for a minute and see if you can connect with this. If you think of grief as a spiral, think of it as this slinky. You know, it's kind of always moving. It's always changing. There's a front of the spiral that's close to your face. There's a back of the spiral that's a little bit farther away. There's space in here that is sometimes wider. Sometimes it's nice and tight. So for a moment, imagine that you lost somebody significant 5 years ago. Your grief spiral may look a bit like this. Maybe stretched out. You've got some space there. I can absolutely see and breathe through this. I can do my day-to-days. Maybe my grief is on the back of the spiral. So it's always in my awareness on some level, but I can see a lot of other things through this. How about when you're driving in the car and that particular song comes on? Or you're walking through Macy's and somebody walks by with a perfume or a cologne and you suddenly are overtaken by sadness. This just happened. That grief came straight to the front of the spiral, right in your face. The space between here is gone. In that moment, your grief is the absolute only thing in your awareness. And that will happen at any time, anywhere. You may know certain places or times of year are more likely to have this happen, but there can be things that are completely out of your control that come up, and suddenly you're right back there. You just introduced yourself to somebody who looks exactly like your brother who died 5 years ago. You thought you were at a good place with it, and now it's taking everything in you to get through this introduction of this person. You just keep staring at him. Could that help? How? And then the sorrow sets in, that heavy sadness. And you think, well, geez, I'm 5 years into this. What's happening here? Think about a child on... So first of all, is this working for you? The idea of grief spiral. Okay. Think about a child on the grief spiral. So they're having days like this, they're having days like this, they too smell a perfume on a teacher or a caretaker that reminds them of grandma or whoever it may be. They have those moments. Add beyond the fact that they're growing and developing, they are typically moving through clean, orderly, forward-moving stages of their development. So let's take the idea of a three-year-old who loses her mother. She's on her grief spiral, experiencing her grief, trying to figure out what it means to be a three-year-old without a mom. There's only so much I can do with that at 3 years old. So I'm trying to figure out, what does this mean in my life at 3 years old for my mommy to die? Fast forward 5 years. She's 8. She's on her grief spiral. She's having days like this. She's having days like this. What does it mean to be an 8-year-old without a mom? It's a little bit different than what it means to be a 3-year-old without a mom. Each time a child goes through a developmental stage, they have a new level of understanding of what that loss is, a new awareness of that missing piece in their lives. Maybe she's part of Brownies now, and there's a mother-daughter event, and all the other Brownies are bringing their moms, and she's not. Maybe she's bringing grandma, or an aunt, or dad's new girlfriend. Or maybe she can't go. That sure does bring her grief right back around to the forefront. And that may do this. And this is a hard place to be. And kids are going to school. Kids are participating in activities. Kids are taking care of their caretakers because they hear daddy crying in the shower. So I'm not going to mention anything about mommy because I know my dad's really sad. You know, our kids are trying to take care of us. They're trying to take care of their big people. We're trying to take care of them too. Take that little girl forward 4 more years. So now we're 12. I didn't like being 12 on a good day, let alone adding something as significant as a loss of a parent. And even though now her loss is how many years old? So 9 years old this loss is. 12 years old. That's a really tough time to not have a mom. And that loss is absolutely going to come back again and again and again. So they will grieve that loss of that person over and over and over again. And their parent or caretaker is in the background thinking, what have I done? I thought we would be over this by now. You know, people say there's a time frame. After a year, it's better. Throw it out the window, right with the stages of grief, because it just doesn't apply. It would be similar to you and I changing positions right now. If I was sitting in that chair and you were up here, we would have completely different experiences of this room. That is what happens. When you go from being 8 years old without a mom to 12 years old without a mom, you've got more information. You've got a different perspective. You've got new experiences. That loss is brand new again, and that loss is going to continue to come back to you. 16, learning to drive. Going to your first prom. Who takes most young ladies to go get their prom dresses? Getting married. Having your first child. As you can see, this is starting to go beyond childhood. We're now growing into an adulthood with this loss still coming back around again and again. And it doesn't have to be a mother. It can be a sister, a brother. Think about a 10-year-old who's a middle child, whose 12-year-old brother dies. What am I scared to death of? When I become 12, I'm afraid I'm going to die. And when I don't, I live to be 13, now I feel really bad. Why did I get to be 13? Well, my brother didn't. And then I get my first job, and I graduate college, and I meet somebody. These are all things that my big brother was supposed to be able to do. And so there's a little piece of it that's always kind of rusty because he was supposed to be able to do this, and he wasn't. Or for a parent, we always ask each other questions, trying to get to know one another. Where do you work? Do you have children? You have children. How many children do you have? How about a mom who's lost a child? I'm going to get into that a little bit more with some of the artwork. Any thoughts or questions or comments about this so far?
I feel like, I mean, I understand where you're going in terms of loss, and I'm not a counselor or psychologist, so I don't really know, but I feel like that there would be some lessening. I mean, if there was some healing going on, mm-hmm. that it's not going to have the same intensity, or it's not going to.
Right.
I mean, I just, because I feel like then we'd all be in grief.
We'd be a mess.
Ever.
We'd always be a mess. Absolutely. No, I think in thinking of the spiral, we over time, not in any particular amount of time, but over time, we do tend to spend more time here. Where that grief is stretched out a bit, it's more so in the peripheral, it's not right there in the front of our awareness. It's there, and at any time, it has the potential to get here. And that's the piece that I think people forget with children. They're learning and developing and gaining new insight and awareness. We all are as adults, and as we age, we get more wise and we have new insights. Children are doing it so rapidly, and they have these situations in their worlds where so-and-so is supposed to be here. So-and-so is supposed to be here. Wait, you have a mom to do that with you, and I don't. So many more reminders as they're just trying to grapple growing up and getting through middle school and high school and all of these situations that tend to bring that awareness back around maybe more often than it does for adults.
To qualify for the caring place, does it have to be through death?
Yes. So what I talk about today...
some children are in grief constantly. They're living with addiction or mental illness.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think what I talk about today can apply to all of those situations. But the program that we provide at the Caring Place is specific to loss by death, and we barely keep up with that population. But we try to make sure that what we offer is extremely high quality, and so we limit it to that. But what we talk about today can be applied to all of those situations.
You mentioned something a little bit ago about Dad has a new girlfriend. Mm-hmm. So when Dad loses his wife so young, chances are he is going to be married. What does that do to the grief of the child?
You know,
I shouldn't be sad anymore because I have a new mommy, but she's not my mommy.
It's different for all of them. And some children, as you say that, I picture this one little girl that came to the Caring Place, and Dad started to bring a new lady friend with him. He had come to the Caring Place 4 or 5 times, and the woman started to join them at the Caring Place. And this little girl, from the moment I met her, this little girl wanted a mom. She just wanted a mom. And I think her need for a mom so far outweighed her understanding of that loss that she was attached to this woman's side. That is exactly what she needed in her world. And other children have a really hard time with that. So it's just so different. It's all over the place when it comes to that particular piece. Grief in general is kind of all over the place. That's why I don't like the stages. So in your folder, you don't have to follow this along right now, but there is a copy of The Grief Spiral. And there are listed on there reconciliation needs, and we look at those sort of as tasks that we think families in general need to go through over time in no particular order. I'm going to go through them in an order just because it helps. But families can address these different needs and tasks at any point in their grief journey. I'm going to start with acknowledging the reality of loss. When children and families come to the Caring Place, they are given the opportunity to tell their story. In a room with all the other families that are at the Caring Place, we ask them to introduce themselves, thank you, who it is that they brought with them, and who it is that died. When we're talking to our families and children, we use the word death and died. We don't say passed away or passed on or lost, because that gets a little bit confusing. Kids are pretty concrete. I can lose a pencil and find it later if I look hard enough. If I lose grandma, I can't find her.
Go to sleep is the worst one.
We have had so many conversations with kids about going to sleep forever. There are things that people tell children in the midst of the hardest moments of their life, so you can't judge it, but think about a 6-year-old whose daddy went to sleep forever. Who's mommy waking up next to at 2 o'clock in the morning every night? Like this.
Yeah.
Making sure mommy's not going to go to sleep forever. I'm not going to sleep, and I don't want you to go to sleep, because I know what that means now. We had a dad whose little girl, he was coming to the caring place. Before he came to the caring place, he said, "I haven't told her." And the loss had occurred 6 weeks prior. And we said, "Well, you've told her something." And he said, "Every time I sat down to try to tell her that her mother died, I just look at her little face and those little eyes, and I can't do it. I can't blame her. I've never had to look at my child and say something like that. Mommy's been at work for a really long time, and that's hard." You know, and in hindsight, I think, what were you thinking? But in that moment, I can't say that I would have such an easy time having that conversation. But we had to help them have that conversation so that they can build some trust in their relationship and move forward before that becomes a damaging factor. We always encourage families to be honest with their children to the most appropriate extent possible. You can leave out some gory details that's not necessary for them understanding. They're going to find out soon enough. But we do think that children have to know that somebody died when they come to the caring place. That's number one. But we do think it's important that children know a little bit about what has happened to you. It's hard for kids if somebody just disappears. To have a little bit of understanding is very helpful to them. So acknowledging the loss. You know, coming to the caring place is acknowledging that somebody has died. Walking through those doors. You don't walk through a grieving center's doors if somebody hasn't died. So that is a part of it. We had a little girl that would come in every single week. She drew the same version of this painting every week. And it would have slight variations. It always said, "I love you." It always said, "I miss you." And it usually said something about Daddy. She had the need to tell her story again and again and again. And that's what kids do. They'll ask you the same question again and again and again and again. Typically not on purpose to drive you crazy, but sometimes it feels that way. When they're trying to understand something like this, the questions are in high gear and they are on fast repeat. "You know, I thought we already talked about what happened to Daddy. Why do we have to do this again and again? This is, you know, killing me to have this conversation." She's just trying to get the facts. She's trying to understand what's going on here. So here she is telling her story. This is her story. The children in the group rooms are given the opportunity to introduce themselves to one another. They each get a little person, and they'll describe themselves on one side. And on the back, they'll describe the person who died. So this little guy likes the NFL, he likes tomatoes, he likes Coke and blue. And his dad, he's here because his dad died, and his dad liked the color red and must have drank a lot of milk. That's his story. That's who I am, and that's who died. Acknowledging the reality of the death. There are lots of different versions of this, and we've done this something similar with adults. It doesn't look exactly the same, but giving them that opportunity. Mr. Rogers, did you have something to say?
They're all smiling.
They are all smiling.
So that's good.
They are all smiling. Mr. Rogers had a lot to do with the creation of the caring place, which is kind of neat. And he tells a story, he used to tell a story about going to a school one time with all of his puppets. And he is all of the puppets. And the little girl had her fish died that morning. And she went to each puppet and said, "My fish died this morning. My fish died this morning. My fish died this morning." She told every single one of them her story because they have that need to tell their story. We don't always ask kids to tell us their story. We don't always give them that opportunity. Because a lot of times, you know, the world's happening up here and they're kind of existing down here. The world's like way above them. We don't always take the time to get down there and say, "What is your story? What has happened?" And then to actually listen. So that's one of the first things that they get the opportunity to do at the caring place. And when I say these don't happen in any particular order, it seems like, well, of course, you have to acknowledge it before you start talking about memories. We have a dad who's been coming to the caring place for about 6 years, and he and his daughter have been coming. He can talk about memories and feelings. He is down that road. He cannot step foot into the house that they lived in. And he can't sell it either. He's paying a mortgage on a home that he cannot live in. Acknowledging the reality of the debt. Hasn't happened yet. He's doing a lot of these other things, but he's not acknowledging the reality of the debt. And that's okay. No, there's no particular order here. Oftentimes, we see this earlier on, but there are times that it's different. Moving into feelings, I brought my little helper to teach us about feelings. A lot of times, kids don't understand what they're feeling. They don't know the word for it. I know for myself, if I know bad news is coming, I get this hot feeling in my chest. It kind of goes down into my stomach. I don't know if there's a biological word for that, but don't tell me it's not real because I know it's real. It happens. Kids get those kinds of things too, and you probably have your own version of something like that. When you know something bad is happening, your body kind of has that particular reaction that you're aware of. Kids have it happen, and they have no idea what this is. They think they're dying. You know, this hot feeling comes over my body, or my knees feel like rubber. We know that feeling. They're starting to have these feelings, but they don't have the same experience with these feelings as we do. So we give them an opportunity to learn about these feelings. So again, in their groups with kids similar ages, we'll do a body drawing. And they lay down and we trace their bodies and they decorate their body. This little girl was coming to the caring place because her mother died. Her mother's favorite color was purple, and her mom always had her nails done. And so she incorporated a little bit of mom into her person. I'll come back here. And then she identifies where in her body she feels her grief. And if when I come close enough, you can see her heart has the word burning. Her belly says hurty. Her knees say weak. And her eyes say happy. Is that an okay combination of feelings? There's no right or wrong. You know, she's got hope. She's still a happy girl. But she's got this stuff going on. She gets that burning sensation in her heart. That might be the same thing I get. She has a hurty belly, which is really common in kids after a loss. And these knees, so I had the privilege of walking in during the conversation about these knees. There were three kids that had knees identified. Now when they do this, they don't have words yet. They're just identifying the spots on the body. There was quite an intense conversation going on with seven-year-olds about the feeling in the knees. And one little guy was saying, I don't know, my knees just feel like they're shaking sometimes. When anyone mentions my brother, my knees just start shaking. And a little girl said, well, those are weak knees. I know that. My mom told me those are weak knees. And she just said, all right, that sounds good to me. And so they all went with weak knees. And the shaky guy let go of the shaky knees and went with the weak knees. Because that's the word for it. I know I was sharing with Paul, I was having stomach issues for a while. And I was getting these scans and these tests and everything was inconclusive and nothing's going on. Something's going on and it's scary because I don't know what it is. So what's happening in my stomach? Do I have cancer? Is it an ulcer? Give me a word so I can do something about it. They needed a word. What is happening to my body? This is what's happening to my body. You said going to sleep is like a really scary thing to say to kids. Someone getting sick and dying is also kind of scary to say to kids, although it does happen. We have to be really careful about the language that we use because what's going to happen to a child who then gets sick after somebody in their family got sick and died? In my head, I'm probably going to die. Or if somebody else in my family is sick, that person's going to die. You know, it's as plain and simple as that for most kids. I feel like this group can handle this. If I'm wrong, somebody give me the hook and I'll stop. We had a family that came in. The mother brought her son. Father had some mental illness and called the mother into the kitchen in their home and completed suicide in front of her with a gun. Very loud noise in the house. Mother screams. Son comes running into the kitchen. Mom says, Daddy got sick. Get out of the room. Okay? In this horrible nightmare of a moment, daddy got sick, get out of here. The image that that child has already gotten into their brain with the word getting sick connected to it led him down a path of anxiety and fear every time he got sick. Kids get sick. He was in the nurse's office panicking very regularly. And mom had to be able to have a conversation with him about the kind of sickness that daddy had, and that daddy didn't get sick in that moment. Mommy got scared, and that's the word that she chose. And she just had a really honest conversation with him, and he was able to get less and less afraid when he was sick. He realized that's not exactly what happens when you get sick. But daddy was sick, and daddy had some things going on in his life. And so she was able to help him understand that is not what happens when you get sick, and that he doesn't have to worry about that happening to him when he is sick. It's really hard to know the right things to say and do. Kids don't come with a handbook with nothing going on, let alone grief or witnessing, you know, the seconds after somebody has completed suicide. That's very, very traumatic. It's hard to know what to say.
How old was he?
He was 9. And that's a scary image for her. I don't want to see something like that, let alone, and she's knowing what she saw, what her child saw. That's a lot to deal with. And just so you know, at the Caring Place, you know, we're not doing counseling and therapy, so we're not technically equipped to support that kind of situation. And in that situation, we are working with the family to get them the support that they need for that trauma before they come to us. Because we have wonderful volunteers working with our families who are not ready to deal with something on that level. Neither am I in that situation. So please know, we don't just think that we can handle everything. We know there are limitations to a program that's primarily driven by volunteers. Thinking about feelings, there's a lot of feeling words out there. We can say to most kids, how are you today? They say good, bad, fine. Here's a list that a group put together of the feelings that they have felt since their person has died. There's a lot of words on here. Empty, yeah. Think about a kid feeling empty.
Guilty.
You know, I could go on with stories and stories. I'm watching the clock. They feel these feelings. There's happiness and relief sometimes. Not every single person who dies is a saint. Abusers die. And a little guy who said he feels happy that his uncle died. He's sad that his uncle died, but he's happy that his uncle died. Because the last time he saw his uncle came into the house and hit his mother and took her purse. And he was glad they didn't have to be afraid of his uncle anymore. You know, that's hard. Or to see somebody suffering for a while. Well, they're happy. I'm happy that grandma doesn't have to suffer anymore. That's
maybe
okay.
They feel guilty about being happy later on.
It happens. Our adults, I want to say almost 100% of the time, will say, if I have a good day, I feel guilty that I had a good day. If I feel relieved that this person isn't sick anymore, then I feel guilty that I felt relieved. Now, grief is so tricky like that. There's so much into it. Feelings masks, an opportunity to share what's going on. So these are the feelings that I'm comfortable sharing with all of you. In the amount of time we've known each other, this is what you're getting. We all do this. We all do this. We wear a mask to work. We wear certain masks with certain family, certain friends. And maybe there's the most close inner tight circle that you share this stuff with. Now, these colors have certain meanings to them. I don't know exactly what this child chose for these colors, but you know, maybe blue means brave, and yellow means a little worried. So he shows people a lot of bravery, and a little bit of worry is what he shows people. On the inside, there's a little more worry there. There's a little less bravery there. There's some anger.
How young can they be to understand the inner and outer?
We do this with our
young age.
We do this with our young group, the 6 to 9 year olds, and we see the colors working for them. And this is probably from a young room because there's not a ton of colors. The teens, there will be so many different intricate details to these the inside becomes really, really detailed. But this is probably a young room. We've got about three feelings going on in here. And even our youngest kids will say that they're trying to be really brave. Because we continue to send messages to young boys, you're the man of the house, or to young girls, you have to take care of your family now. So they're trying to do that. And we're trying to get rid of those messages, because that's a lot of stress. It's hard to figure out how to be a 15-year-old, let alone be the man of the house. Memories. Cherishing memories. Trying to forget certain memories. Giving kids the opportunity to talk about memories, their own memories. Maybe they don't have very many memories. Maybe they need your help. No, if I was 3 when my mom died, I don't have much. So I need you to help me know what my mom was like so that I can have a piece of her and I can talk about her when everybody else is talking about her so I don't feel so left out. She was my mom. I can't even remember what she sounded like. Or kids who are 5, 6, when their person dies, they are worried they're going to forget. And they're going to forget a lot. So to give them a space where they can preserve and cherish. So this was made by a little guy. This box says, I love you, Dad. I think Dad was probably somehow involved in the military. And this is a spot where he can keep his memories. We had a teen who made one. Her grandpa lived with her, and grandpa was her buddy. That was her best friend. Grandpa smoked a particular kind of cigarette that had a very distinct smell. And so anytime she was somewhere and smelled that, she would like, think, Grandpa's here. When Grandpa died, Grandma gave her Grandpa's last pack of open cigarettes. She promised not to smoke them, but she said, sometimes she just takes a sniff and thinks about Grandpa. That's okay. No, and her memory box is loud and proud in the middle of the living room. Other kids will take this and hide it in the deepest, darkest corner underneath their bed or in a closet, and that's okay too. It's whatever they want it to be. As adults, we'll often have our own keepsakes or a scrapbook or an album. We sometimes forget to give kids those opportunities too. Let me have my own set of pictures and give me some stories that I can talk about when people are talking about my mom. I can tell a story too. Identity. This is about, you know, thinking about that middle kid whose older brother died. Who am I now? Am I the oldest? Am I still the middle? What happens when I surpass his age? Has he become younger? Is he still my older brother? Like, I'm trying to figure this all out. What is the first thing that you are asked when you walk into Red Lobster?
How many?
If you're a family that just had a loss, you're going out to dinner for the very first time, that question will ruin your appetite. Because we've always been a party of 5. And now, for all intents and purposes at Red Lobster, we are a party of 4.
It's even harder if they know you.
Where's Jimmy?
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, last I saw you, Jimmy was going into the military. How are things? Those are those things that come out of nowhere that bring that grief right back around. We have the kids do, and adults do, family trees. So in each of these, 2 people have died. Which one's right?
They're both right.
This kiddo chose to put 2 of the people on the trunk and 2 in the leaves. The 2 on the trunk might be the ones who died. Maybe it's the ones on the leaves. This kiddo kept everybody together. 2 family trees. They're both right. That identity. Who are we? What is our family now? Thinking about traditions and things that they did with their families. No, here's an activity where we do a holiday plate. And they talk about what they do at Thanksgiving with their family. And who does what and who sits where. And there's a kid table, but Uncle Joe always sits at the kid's table. And that's really funny and whatever. What are we going to do this year? Because Uncle Joe died. And he always sat with us at the kid's table. Or Aunt Kathy died, and Aunt Kathy is always the one who had Thanksgiving. Are we not having Thanksgiving? Are we not having turkey? Because she's always the one that made the turkey. You know, we all brought something, and she always brought the turkey. Do we have no turkey now? We had an 8-year-old who came to the caring place. His dad was a chef, and dad died. And his mother said, Daddy was in a horrible accident, and he died. His first question to her was, how are we going to eat? Daddy cooked. How are we going to eat? And she said, I can cook. Like, I can, we'll survive with my cooking. But, like, that's where his head went. It's just different for him. But then 2 years down the road, you know, if somebody tells him that story, he could feel really bad. My first reaction was food. And we should have been really sad. You know, and we do that to ourselves as kids. And adults model that for the kids. Oh, man. Okay. I'm going to start talking in overdrive here. This is my favorite. We will bring a pot into the group rooms. And the volunteers will help the kids smash the pot. Then they work together to put it back together. And I brought you my favorite one because you can see this. They use all kinds of stuff to put these back together. There's two different types of tape. There's something called model magic, sort of like Play-Doh, and then it dries. And there's gum. It's gross, but it's sticky, and it holds it together. Can this pot do what it's supposed to do? We can put dirt in here, and we can water it, and we can have a little seed in there. We can sure plant a flower. Is this pot ever going to look the same again? Never. This is very much what has happened in their lives. When their person died, their life has changed forever. They will never look exactly the same. But it can work. And it may take varying degrees of gum and tape to get it there. And we may still lose a piece here and there, or a piece may need replaced. But it can do its job. And we can be a family. We're just never going to look the same. Those cracks and missing pieces are always going to be visible. And that's okay. And the kids, even our young kids, can understand this. We had a kid say, he was 11, he said, you know, this pot is a little bit more like my mom than it is our family. Because I feel like we're doing okay. I feel like we're always trying to put my mom back together. He said, she doesn't eat with us anymore. She drinks a lot of wine, and she cries. You know, and that's a sign to us. Check in with mom. How are you doing? And she said, terrible. I don't eat. All I do is drink wine and cry. Exactly what her son said. I didn't say, well, you know what? Joey told me that. That's why I asked. He was worried about his mom. And the kids are told, what they tell us is held in confidence, unless, obviously, they're going to hurt somebody or hurt themselves. I needed to check in on mom to see how she was doing, so we did. And she let us help her. And she got into treatment, and she was able to stop that train in its tracks. She was hurting. And you know what? Alcohol sometimes makes things stop hurting. It is a coping skill. It's a really bad one, but it works, and it works really fast. When I worked in addiction for my internship, I was astonished at how much grief there was behind almost every addiction. We're just not that good at addressing and supporting grief. We're trying to get better. This is my favorite. So the real test is, how well do I know the grief spiral? So we move into thinking about the whys. All those questions that are really hard to answer. Why me? Why my dad? Where is he now? You know, people talk about heaven. I can't see heaven. Prove it. I don't know where he is. We have a team. This is our team question box. And teens are given the chance to write questions and add them to the box. So I pulled the top one out. They're all in there. Do you believe in repercussions for your actions? Is there something after death, and do your actions affect it? This is what they're thinking about. It's deep. It's hard. These are tough things. And to feel like they don't want to ask their adult at home because they don't want to upset their adult, these are the questions that are on their mind. So we talk about it at the caring place. We have conversations about it at the caring place. And it's not just teens that are thinking this way. This is a picture that was drawn by a four-year-old. This is a picture of where mommy lives. Right up here says heaven. He's trying to figure it out. Where is she? Where did she go? What is this forever stuff? He drew her home. Now, to us, before and now, this may just look like a big blue blob. This is really important. This is where mommy lives. And that's really special, and to give him the opportunity to explore his thoughts and feelings about that in a place where he's going to be safe and respected and loved. Allowing kids to wonder and wish. So another preschooler, we created a wish wand because she was just always saying, I wish that I could wish. Somebody told her she can't wish. We can wish. We can all wish. So we made her a wish wand. I destroyed a bubble thing. This had like a long thing for bubbles. Ripped that off, put glue and glitter glue and water in here, then hot glued it together. And she added some beads and ribbons, and this is her wish wand, and she will wish that mommy could come back. And that's all right, because she's little. And we like to wonder, what would that be like if we could get mommy back here? What would we tell her? What would we do with her? We had a little guy who said, well, I don't understand why we can't just call daddy. He always has a cell phone. Let's just call him. He always has it. You know, all right, let's call him. What will we say to him? You know, we always took a plane to visit grandma. Why can't we just take a plane to visit grandma still? What kind of plane would we need? Would it be really big or really small? How long would our flight be? Are they going to have food on this flight? Because a lot of airlines are really cutting back. You know, wonder with them. It's different than a 17-year-old saying, daddy always had a cell phone, why can't we call him? These are little kids. We had a little girl, you know, just thinking about how the information changes for them. They have new levels of understanding. A little girl whose daddy died in a drowning accident. She was 4. And she said to her volunteers that daddy got eaten by a monster. We don't tell our volunteers all of the details, any of the details of the death, because we want kids and families to tell it when they're ready and how they're ready. And so, you know, for a 4-year-old, monsters are very real. And that's why we're afraid of what's under our bed. And we have, like, squirt guns to kill the monsters in our bedrooms at night. And somebody has to come in and check there's no monster in the closet. Monsters eat people. Daddy's gone. A monster at my dad. Those are the facts. That's okay. I'm not going to correct her. She's 4. She's going to figure this out. A few weeks later, daddy forgot to eat. And then he went swimming, and he died. She's getting closer. In her world, I think we all knew the rule about swimming and eating, like you don't eat and then swim or something like that. And so she's got some information here. There was some kind of rule about eating and swimming, or you'll get sick, or maybe die. And so that must be what happened. Because daddy died in water. I bet he forgot to eat. She's putting it together. That's okay. I'm not running in with the facts. Oh, no, no, no. Here's what happened. She's 4. She's trying to put it together with the information that she has. Again, different when you're talking about a 15-year-old. And then the last need that we talk about is finding a supportive adult presence in years moving forward. So they can come to the caring place, and we're wonderful. And they get a lot out of coming to the caring place. And there's a time that the caring place ends, and they need to know who they can go to for support. So with our littler ones, we have our helping hands. We trace their hands, and they identify who they can go to when they're feeling sad or when they want to talk about their brother. Who can they talk to? As we get older, sometimes we need a list of the people to not call and talk to, because they always kind of make us feel worse after talking to them. Again, when I worked in addiction, one of the biggest things was around relapse was to have a list of names and phone numbers. Because when that drug starts whispering, it's going to get louder, and you're going to be less and less able to hear your memory saying, call your sister, here's her phone number, call your sister. You need a list in your back pocket or on your person somewhere. Okay, my sister and her phone number, and you dial the numbers. Similar. I feel sad. Where's my helping hands? Ashley. I go find Ashley. A support bridge. They create a bridge out of the support that they have. So there might be names on here. I can play piano because that tends to make me feel a little bit better. I can talk to my mom. I can read. I can paint my nails. I can go shopping. Whatever it is, it's listed here, where they can find some support, whether it's with a person or with something that they can do.
But never, ever tell them what they just said wrong.
Never. No.
Well, that's not what happened to your daddy at all.
No. You know, if they're 15 and they're talking about a monster eating daddy and they're developmentally, you know, a fairly on the right path and that's happening, those are some red flags that something's going on and something needs addressed. Thinking about the adults who are bringing children to the caring place. So the kids, just a little bit about the program, the kids are broken up by ages. I've talked a lot about the preschoolers, the young kids, the teens. We also have a middle room, 10, 11, 12. We keep them in kind of developmentally similar spaces because their level of understanding of the death is similar to one another versus what a 3-year-old understands next to a 13-year-old. We don't break up the adults by age because I think that would be offensive, but we do break them up into all the 50-somethings over here. You don't belong in here. Exactly. So we break them up by the relationship they had with the person who died. So it might be, I'm an adult that's going into the spousal loss group. So every adult in this room knows what it's like to lose their spouse, their best friend, the person that they were spending forever with. We had children together. We had plans. We were supposed to retire. We were supposed to travel. We were supposed to watch our children graduate together. That's a really unique loss. And you don't totally understand that unless you've had that loss. Maybe I'm in this room, and we have all lost children. You do not know what it is like to lose a child unless you've lost a child. To be surrounded by people who understand that loss, it is never exactly the same. But that pain, we can understand that pain. And we have a mixed loss group. And that is for if it was grandma who died, or a cousin, or my ex-husband. So, you know, maybe I divorced the guy 10 years ago. I'm not that upset. But my kids are upset, and we need to be here. I don't think I should sit next to the people who are really upset. So I'm going to go in this mixed loss group. And then we have some, we just recently had a woman say, I'd had to divorce my husband for the safety of our family. He was gambling and using drugs, and it was going to hurt us. And I had to, and it's the last thing I ever wanted to do. And I still love him to my core. And although we were divorced, I want to be in the spousal loss group because I'm hurting so much because I lost my best friend. And so she's in the spousal loss group. We don't say, no, sorry, you're over there. They find support, they find those connections, they find a new community of care and support for one another. we all know families are wonderful, and, you know, you go to a holiday dinner or a family reunion, and it's great, and then, you know, the comments start, you know, you got to do this, you got to stop wearing that wedding ring, you got to move on, it's been 3 years, lose the wedding ring. Oh, you stopped wearing the wedding ring already, on to the next one. You know, we're just crazy with the things we say to one another. So to come to the caring place where everyone in the room gets it, we all have that sister-in-law who says the most ridiculous things, and you know she sort of means well, but it still hurts. And to come to the caring place, everyone there gets it. They probably heard something similar too. So a little bit, yes?
I have a question about the adults. Now, the adults that come to the caring place come because they have brought children.
Yeah.
And then there's also a group for them.
Yes.
But adults don't come there by themselves.
No, there's a lot of support groups out there for adults, and we will find them one. And that's one thing, you know, if you call the caring place and you're not necessarily the best fit, you know, we're not the right thing for you at the time, you would not be the wrong fit. We would be the wrong fit. If we're not the right fit for you at this time, we're going to find you what is. We sometimes work harder with families that don't come to the caring place than with the families that are coming to the caring place. Sometimes things are really complicated.
Is the only location you have in Warrendale?
No. We have one on Stanwyck Street in downtown.
Okay.
We have Warrendale, Erie, and right outside of Harrisburg.
Okay.
Yes?
This is probably a longer question than you have time to answer, but do you have resources on how to more universalize this? Because you guys are dealing with specifically with death.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I'm working in a skilled nursing center,
mm-hmm.
that they're dealing with grief of loss,
yes.
loss of independence,
yes.
stuff like that. And I was just wondering if there are any resources that...
I can't think of resources off the top of my head, but what I can tell you is I've definitely done educational trainings and in-service trainings with facilities like that who are working with that population because there is so much loss involved there. And it's really similar, you know, to we talk about the grief spiral, and we tweak it a little bit to address some of the things that are going on. And it's more of a collaborative training where I'm coming in with the grief spiral knowledge, and then we're using everybody in the group here to apply the losses to the grief spiral and how that loss of what was supposed to be is coming back around for me. So we can definitely apply it in that way.
Are your volunteers former people that have come?
Sometimes, but more...
Do they have to be?
No, no. And you all have a volunteer brochure in your folder today. So, no, you do not have to have had a loss or come to the caring place. We actually, if a family comes to the caring place and then wants to be a volunteer, we actually require that they wait 2 years before they try to be a volunteer, because that's really tough to shift like that.
Regarding the, you made a comment about you want families, not just kids by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So is it possible for a child to come with a sibling that is an adult?
I think that each situation we look at differently.
Okay.
And if it's a safe, appropriate situation, we'd be fine with it. You know, there are times that an aunt or grandma or grandpa is now raising kids, and, you know, if
right.
the ages are right and it feels safe and okay, then absolutely.
Okay.
We've also gotten into schools now because there are kids that can't get to us, whether it's financial reasons, transportation, or mom has to work 3 jobs now, and she can't even see her kid, let alone get them to the caring place. We are now in schools doing support groups in schools, so we're reaching kids that we wouldn't otherwise reach.
Can I just share something?
Yes, absolutely.
I had asked Rhonda if I might just share a little bit of my story, because the caring place has been a blessing in my life. After my mother passed and I was an adult, I had finished working at Highmark and I went to volunteer. And I walked into the caring place and I saw the bronze tree on the wall and knew that it was a place that I needed to start. When my dad was diagnosed at I was 12, he passed when I was 15, and every family member between there and my mother, I had not ever grieved. And the caring place was the blessing for me, because in that training, I learned how to grieve. And in my faith community, I was brought up in the church, it wasn't something that was ever addressed. People didn't know how to help children. And I don't know that it's still out there in our faith community. So I am just a real strong supporter of the caring place, and I hope that you'll not only consider volunteering, but also taking it into your faith community. Thank you.
Thank you, Paula. Does somebody else have a?
I wasn't sure what to expect coming in, and mm-hmm. this has really touched me. I actually lost both my parents at the age of 7. And so a lot of what you have said has really touched me. And I've found, actually now it's been, 35 years, and it's still difficult in those times. And I actually just probably about 3 weeks ago was in a store and bought a butterfly net. And I was so excited about it. And I think it was probably packaged back 35 years ago because it looked like that. And, so I'm actually still, I'll always grieve, but I'm connecting as a child now as an adult.
Good.
Because I didn't have that full opportunity.
Absolutely. Thank you for sharing that. And I think that, to give yourself permission to connect with that child and to grieve, there's not a right time. And we just didn't have the kind of support or understanding of grief back then with kids. And I hear it all the time. People come to, if I'm at a booth in the community or after training, they'll say, where was this place when I was a kid? Because grief happens. And that's just a personal testament to how it continues to come back around. Thank you.
I'd like to piggyback on what Sherry just said. I lost my parents when I was 20. I was in the convent, and you just, went on with life.
Mm-hmm.
I lost my best friend when we were 26. I lost my favorite brother when we were 30. It was not until my husband died 9 years ago that I realized I had never grieved any of that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very helpful, to get, do the work you need to do, even if it's delayed long. But
absolutely. Thank you.
Quilts.
Oh, yes. So, go ahead.
I serve as a pastor in a subsidized housing community.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of challenges just in terms of where they're able to get to, things like that.
Yep.
Are there any kind of resources you can recommend in that regard? I guess their schools is not really one of the sites.
Right, so that was part of our challenge from the community was how can we get to you without getting to you? And that was us getting into the schools. And we're working really hard with city schools that are tougher to get into and get involved with. But those are the families that are not coming to us. And so we are working so hard to get through those walls to be in city schools. If you have a particular area, my card is in your folder. Please get in touch because we may have a contact or some idea that maybe we can come and do some kind of training with adults that can take the information and think about it with their children. We can be open to ideas like that. So everybody has my card. My face is on it because they did research that says you will feel bad to throw my face in the garbage. And you'll hang on to that for 7 years on average. So in 7 years, when you throw me away, just know it worked. So you won't forget. I feel like a real estate agent when I do that. But one of our managers did the research, and the next thing you know, there's a box of 1,000 cards on my desk with my face smiling back at me. Paula brought up the quilts, and I know we're over. Please don't. I'm not going to be offended if you leave, but we offer families that come through the Caring Place. So we have two types of groups, an introductory group where we meet 10 times over the course of a couple of months. It's every other week. The program is in the evenings. We serve dinner. It's all taken care of. At the end of those 10 sessions, we give families an opportunity to decorate a quilt square in honor of their loved one. And we have a team of quilters, volunteer quilters, who put it all together. And the quilts line the walls of all of our caring places. And so a family can come back at any time and see their loved one's story on that quilt, and they're beautiful. And it's one of the hardest things we ask our families to do. Put your person's story on this little piece of fabric and then leave it with me. That's tough. That's an emotional thing, and then to leave it with us. But we care so much for them and take such good care of them. They hang on our walls, and they are the caring place. When you walk through those walls and you see those faces and those stories, that's the caring place. We're not the caring place without those stories. You are all invited at any time to contact me and come in for a tour downtown or Warrendale. If you really insist, I will meet you in Harrisburg or Erie, and we'll often feed you, too. We emotionally eat a lot at the Caring Place. So I was getting married when I first started at the Caring Place, and I actually had to get my gown wet out. We eat stuff. But it was an all right problem to have. There could be worse problems. Thank you so much for your time. was so much more I wanted to say. We'll do it again sometime. Thank you. Have a great day. Please contact me anytime.